Welcome to the Biblical Languages Podcast, brought to you by Biblingo. We bring together the latest research in linguistics, language acquisition, and biblical studies to better understand the biblical languages and ultimately the biblical text. As always, this episode is brought to you by Biblingo, the premier solution for learning, maintaining, and enjoying the biblical languages. Visit biblingo.org to learn more and start your 10-day free trial.
Welcome to the Biblical Languages Podcast, brought to you by Biblingo. I'm Kevin Grosso, and today I will be doing a wrap-up episode for our New Testament translation series. So here's an overview of what we're going to talk about today. First, we'll talk about translation goals. So we'll discuss some of the issues that have been brought up in previous episodes on what we should be actually doing when we translate. Second, we'll talk about translation methods. So how do we translate a text with that goal in mind and successfully accomplish that goal? So the question with methods is how. And again, we had a lot of discussion with different people about how that's done best. Finally, we'll look at some translation problems, some that were brought up and others that were not brought up in the series. And finally, we'll look at just a few key principles on how to read translations. Most people are reading the Bible through a translation. So it's important to keep in mind that it is a translation if you are reading through a translation and all that that entails, what it means to be reading a translation rather than original text. So first, translation goals. In the introductory episode with Dr. Anthony Pym, he basically said that translating is equivalence of some sort. And this is a foundational principle. When you are translating from one language to another, you are making two things equivalent. So you can make two things equivalent in different ways. In particular, you can match form or you can match meaning. So when you match form, you can actually take the Greek words and put them into English letters, for example. And we'll get into some of these details in the methods section. So that would be a case where you are literally matching the Greek letters and mapping them onto English letters, so they are equivalent. When people normally talk about formal equivalence, what they mean is that one Greek word matches to one English word, and they translate that consistently every time. So the basic issue with that perspective is that there is actually no formal match between a Greek word and an English word, because there's always going to be a slight difference in meaning between one Greek word and one English word. An example that we talked about with Scott McKnight is porewamai, go. So this word, I think Scott translated travel or journey. It most of the time means go, and he knows this, and he said that. But he wanted to use one Greek word for one English word, so he translated it as journey or travel every single time. Now, when you do this, you are suggesting that porewamai should be mapped onto this other English word. But the reality is that choosing that English word is always going to be an approximation. So there's really no reason why you should privilege the sense of travel or journey, right, over the sense go, because both senses are possible, and it is, you know, a number of things that determines which sense is being used in which context. But that just means that there is really no idea of formal equivalence, and we'll get to this more in a minute. But that's what people mean when they say that they are translating with a formal equivalent perspective. So the next question is meaning. Can we match meaning from one language to the next? And really, what does it mean to match meaning? So people who advocate for formal equivalence are really suggesting that you should match meaning at the word level, right? What they're really saying is this Greek word means this English word, or this is the best meaning that we have in English for this Greek word, and I'm just going to match it as many times as I can. Okay, so what they're actually doing, they're not translating the form, they're actually translating per word, right? And they call it a word-for-word translation. So you can do this, right? You can try to match roots. And so again, this is something that got brought up in my discussion with Scott McKnight. Some of the pushback he got was he translated kratos, which is normally power. He translated it as grip. And the reason why he did is krateo is the verb, and it means to grip or hold on to something. So he said, oh, okay, I'm going to match the root krat. And every time I see this krat root, I'm going to put the grip root in English. So, you know, there's a passage in Revelation that says all glory and honor and grip to God, right? And so this, it sounds very funny, right? And it doesn't make sense in English because the root in Greek does not match perfectly to the root in English. And so basically the further away you move, you know, root level, word level, phrase level, the further down you get, you know, into the word, the more mismatches you're going to have. So it's going to be very, very difficult to match roots in Greek to roots in English. Word level is going to be a little bit easier, but again, there's going to be some mismatches. Phrase level, again, it's going to be a little bit easier to match phrases, okay? And we'll get into some of these in a second. But really, when we're talking about matching meaning, what we should be thinking about is matching senses. So if you think about the word run in English, it has many different senses. So my nose can run, and that's very different than me going for a run. When my nose runs, I'm using a particular sense of the word run, and this sense is referring to a specific kind of event in the world. Now, Greek might use the word trecho, run, for that sense, or it might not. So you have to look. Greek probably has a way to talk about the event of your nose dripping snot, right? And so the question is, do we use Greek's way of talking about that event in the world, or do we use English's way saying your nose is running, right? So this is, I think really if we are going after meaning, it does make the most sense to translate the sense of the passage. But this brings up a bigger issue. What kind of meaning are we trying to translate? In particular, semantic versus pragmatic meaning. There is a Bible translation, and this is much more common in the wider Bible translation world, meaning outside of English. There's a Bible translation that I know. I talked to the translator. He translated, I am the bread of life as I am the sweet potato of life. The reason why he did this was because he was translating into a culture where sweet potatoes were the staple food. Bread was viewed as a rich person's food. It was not a staple, it was a luxury item. So when he comes to this passage in John, where Jesus says, I am the bread of life, he knows that in their culture, the biblical culture, bread is the staple food. And he knows that in his culture that he's working with, sweet potato is the staple food. So instead of saying the best equivalent is I am the bread of life, which would have meant that Jesus could be living in luxury or something like that, he translates it as the sweet potato of life. Now, there are problems with this and benefits. And this is, I'm not here to condone or judge any translation, but my only point here is that there are real consequences. So the consequence is that you then lose the culture of the Bible, right? Because this statement is based on a culture where bread is the staple. And they have a history of bread falling from heaven. And they would have immediately connected, I am the bread of life, with manna from heaven. So you would lose that if you do this. So that should be taken into consideration. What you gain is more of the pragmatic meaning in this particular context, right? We know that bread is the staple food. Sweet potatoes is the staple food in this culture. The people would understand, hey, I am the staple food of life, right? Again, there are pros and cons. I have an opinion. I personally wouldn't do this, but it's helpful to understand why people are doing it. They are trying to reflect the pragmatic meaning of the text. If you don't know what pragmatics is, I would encourage you to check out my introduction to pragmatics. I also have an introduction to semantics on the podcast, but that'll help you frame this discussion. But the point here is how people would feel about the text, we'll just say that's pragmatics for the moment, would be more similar with I am the sweet potato of life than I am the bread of life, okay? So this brings up a larger issue of how much should the reader understand of the text? And on the surface, we would say, okay, you should understand as much of the text as you possibly can, really even as much as the original audience would have understood. But the question really is how much, and how much of that do you then put into the translation? So one example is the Tower of Babel. If you are a little bit rusty on your Akkadian, like I am, actually, you might not know, or you might have forgotten, that Babel is the Akkadian word for gate of the god. Bab is gate, and El, Il, right, is god. So Babylon's city is named Gate of the God. The Tower of Babel, the story, is about several different things. But one of the issues in the text, right, is what is this place Babel? What is not necessarily the etymology, though in the story, an alternative definition is given, but what is the significance of the name, right? The writer of Genesis 11 suggests this is the place where all of the languages were confused. By giving this alternative etymology, they are implicitly denying what everyone would have known is the actual etymology of the words in Akkadian, right? Gate of the God, right? So they're saying, no, it's actually not the gate of the God here. This is the place where everything got messed up. So an original reader probably would have understood that because they would have been part of that culture. They would have known what that name is referring to. Do we need to put that in the translation? Should we put the meaning of the word Babel when it is introduced? That would be helpful in understanding. And that's something that it's implicit knowledge for the original audience. It might not be for us. Another example, when you read through Leviticus, many people are confused. Why is the priest getting blood and rubbing it on the altar, for example, or on the horns of the altar? Now, for them, if they had some sort of implicit knowledge about the significance of blood and what it does in these rituals, then they would have immediately understood why the priest would do that. I think they probably did understand. It has been suggested by scholars today that the blood of sacrifices is ritual detergent. This is Jacob Milgram's term for it, and he's the kind of the king of Leviticus. He's a 3-volume commentary on it. Very well respected Leviticus scholar, kind of the Leviticus scholar. So he calls blood ritual detergent. It's something that's ritually used to clean things. So the blood then was rubbed on the altar as a way of cleansing the tabernacle from the sin of the people. Should that be put in translation, right? If the original audience understood it, should we just say blood, and in parentheses, right? This is the ritual detergent. If everyone understood it to be that, I don't know. You know, should we put it in a footnote? Should we put it in a Bible study note? These are all questions, right? But here's the point, is that if we want a translation to convey the same message that the readers would have understood, then we have to be thinking about how they would have read the text. And they would have had all this background knowledge that they're bringing into the text that we are not, right? And we have to be thinking about our target audience's background knowledge. Again, the sweet potato, this particular culture is bringing in knowledge to their understanding of the text. So they might misunderstand a translation just because of their culture. Again, I'm not saying one way or the other what should be done. I'm pointing out that these are the issues that have to be thought about. And really, these have to be thought about on a case-by-case basis, right? At each passage, we have to think about what to do and the ramifications of what we're doing. So as a goal, I think this is pretty standard. I came up with this, but as a goal for translation, saying something like, as much as possible, communicate the same message in the target language that was communicated in the source language. I think that's would be a pretty standard thing to say, right? And it would be something that we as people who want the Bible to be translated should support, right? We want the message of the Bible to go out to all the different languages. It's not that the words need to go out. It's the message. So it's not helpful for me to hand someone a Greek New Testament and say, here's God's word in its purest form, right? If they don't know Greek, it's not going to help them, right? So what I want to do is take that message and communicate it in a way that can be understood. And that means that I had to know the message to begin with, which means that translation necessarily involves interpretation. And we'll get back to this later. But this is the goal, right? Is to transfer meaning from one language to the next. So the question is, how do we do that? There are a lot of different ways to do this. Really, the big dichotomy that has been set up, which I'm about to suggest is kind of a false dichotomy, is literal versus free translations. And again, I mentioned this earlier, this is often associated with dynamic equivalence or formal equivalence, being so-called literal translations and dynamic equivalence being so-called free translations. Again, there is really no such thing as formal equivalence in the sense that a form is copied from one language to the next, unless you actually just transliterate the letters. So we'll get to this, people doing this, and that this is appropriate in some circumstances. And the question is when, right? So the formal equivalence, though, is basically copying one Greek word for one English word. So what they're doing is they're making the meaning correspond at the word level. They're not doing it at the root level. Again, that would just lead to something that's often unintelligible. As I mentioned with Scott's translation, again, Scott is trying to do something different, so that's fine. He's trying to reflect the Greek in a different way. But when English readers read, God should get all of the grip, they actually shouldn't know what it means. I mean, they wouldn't, right? I wouldn't, at least. I wouldn't know that that was referring really to our English word power, the Greek is. So there's really no such thing as formal equivalence in this way. The literal word-for-word thing is I take a word and I replace it with another word that I think is best. But that word itself is an imperfect match to the Greek. That's because Greek words do not literally mean any English word. So people throw this phrase around a lot, right? And you'll see it in dictionaries. See something like, ekbalo, literally throw out. So we understand what people mean by that, this literally throw out. But that assumes that ek means out, and ballo means throw, and that is kind of true, except that you also throw your sword into your sheath in Greek. And so the word ballo is not necessarily the same as the word throw in English. So it just means that there's no reason why we should pick necessarily that English word for that Greek word to begin with. What are even our criteria for doing so? Is it just the amount of times it occurs with that sense? But at that point, like, we know that there are times where those two things don't match, okay? So another issue is syntax. So do we copy syntax from the source language to the target language? And most of the time, people will say that you don't because you can't. But actually, this is something that is pretty difficult because you will actually potentially change the meaning sometimes if you change the order of the sentence. So I'll give an example, Romans 1:17. And this will touch on several things here. In Greek, dikaiosune gar theou en auto apokalyptetai ekpisteos ispistin, kathos grebd gegrebtai, hode dikaios ekpisteos zdeesetai. Okay, so the typical translation, let me back up. First is that keeping the form of the words can change the meaning. So as an example, the phrase ek pisteos eis pistin is translated in the ESV, from faith for faith. Now, I've read this many times in the ESV. I don't know what it means. I don't know what it would mean for the righteousness of God to be revealed in him from faith for faith. I wouldn't use that in English, like when I'm just speaking, to describe any event that I know of. So I actually just don't even understand what it means. So assuming that Paul is not being opaque for his original audience, when we just copy ek, oh, that means from, pisteos, oh, that means faith, ace, oh, that means two or four, oh, pistin, that means faith. And when we just literally copy word for word, we could introduce the wrong meaning. Only to point out, again, maybe other people from faith for faith understand intuitively what that means. But if they don't, right, and Paul was clear to his audience, then there's probably a different way of saying that in English that would be clearer to us. I have a particular interpretation. I think it should be read, the righteousness of God was revealed in him from the faith, for the faith, adding the word "the" there. And there are lots of reasons why that. I have a video on Romans 1:17, if you want to check that out, and why I do that. But then I understand that the faith is the thing that reveals God's righteousness, and it's for the sake of the faith that that righteousness is revealed. That I understand. Now, again, I'm only pointing out that if a translation translates word for word and is not understandable to a native English speaker, most likely keeping that form is changing the meaning in some way, because Paul, we can assume, was being intelligible to his audience. So it's not always best to just keep the form. Sometimes changing the form changes the meaning. So here, again, in this verse, ode dikaios ek pisteos zdesetai. So this is almost always translated, the righteous one will live by faith. Now, if you notice in Greek, ode dikaios ek pisteos, if you were to just literally translate that word for word, it would be the righteous from faith will live. Again, if you understand pisteos to be definite, and there's reasons why it could be best translated into English, the faith, without the definite article there, you can see my video on it. But then we could read it as the righteous one from the faith will live, meaning the righteous member of the faith will live. That's a different meaning than the righteous one will live by faith. In the righteous one will live by faith, all of these translations have moved by faith from being right next to the righteous one to the end of the clause. And in so doing, they have screened out this other possible interpretation. You can't read the English according to my interpretation. You can if you have the word order be the same as it is in Greek, because basically words that modify each other are normally close to one another. And so in English, the righteous one will live by faith. The living is by faith, and the by, right, is right next to live. In the Greek, the ek pisteos, which most people say is by faith, I would say of the faith, in Greek, it's right next to the righteous one. So because of that, it can, and I think should, be taken with dikaios. Here's the point, right? Again, I'm not here to convince you on Romans 1:17. I am suggesting that this is a way in which maybe you should keep the syntax of the Greek, right? Sometimes it needs to change. Other times it doesn't. And so again, the question is, when should it and when should it not? Really, it depends on the meaning. And that ultimately depends on your interpretation of the text. So how do we go about doing this, right? There are different ways that we can go about going from the meaning of the text in one language to the meaning of a text in another language. So this list of methods is from Anthony Pym. He has 7 methods of basically equivalence in different ways. And what I want to show here is that everyone is doing all of these things. The question is just when and why you're doing it. So copying. Sometimes you just need to copy the words, literally transliterate the words from Greek into English so that the English speaker can pronounce it as close as possible to the way that the Greek speaker pronounced it. So names. This is where names come in. Beth Lehem. Again, I mentioned this in the conversation with Doug Moo. Pretty much everyone's going to do this. Beth Lehem will end up being Bethlehem in English. It's essentially a transliteration of the Greek word Bethlehem into English, right? Sometimes you can copy structure. So this is an example from Second Testament. Gai stoma pros stoma lale somen. And we will speak mouth to mouth. And now I'm forgetting where this is. I think it's at the end of 3 John, maybe 3 John 14. But in English, kai stoma pros stoma lale somen, we wouldn't say this in English. We would say, and we will speak face to face, right? So we have an idiom that's actually very close. Even the more literal translations, LSB, ESV, right? NASB, then they translate this as we will speak face to face, right? Because they're like, okay, stoma just means, you know, the same thing as face in our idiom. And it sounds really funny to say, and we will speak mouth to mouth. So again, everyone is doing this. The Second Testament is trying to reflect the Greek more. And so he says, we will speak mouth to mouth. But most of the time in these kinds of instances, you're not going to copy structure. You're going to do something different. And in particular, that brings us to our next point. You will change the expression. This is an expression change. So here we have different ways of doing this, four different subcategories here. You can change the perspective. So the NLT does this in 1 John 4:18. The Greek says, "Hode phobumenos ou teteleotai in te agape." And so a word for word, right? If I were just go word for word and translate into English, it would be the one who fears has not, I have to translate teteleotai. So I think, and I have reasons for this, that it should be like manifested. So the one who fears has not manifested love, right? Something like that. So in the NLT, and I'm going to, again, it's not important how we translate or what our particular understanding is of this verse, but the NLT says, this shows that we have not fully experienced his perfect love. So the perspective change is, in one case, in the Greek, it's clear that we're talking about a generic person, the one who fears has not been perfected, right? Which the NLT translates as fully experienced, often translated as perfected, I would say manifested. But there is no we. The NLT has a we. This shows that we have not fully experienced his perfect love. So it changes this generic person to we. That's just a perspective change. So sometimes this will help the reader to understand what's going on in the original text better. Again, this is just a method to employ sometimes when a certain text might be suggesting something in Greek that's harder to say in English without this perspective change. Another subcategory of expression change is density change. So this is when you offer more of an explanation for something than is what's given in the original. And so this is, I think, one of the interesting examples of this is the Targums. And this happens a lot in the Targums. The Targums are Aramaic translations of the Old Testament, Hebrew Bible, and they are often giving explanations that are not in the original text. Now, is that wrong? I mean, I don't know. I mean, but it's doing something different than the original. If everyone understood it in a certain way, then it might be preserving some sort of meaning that was lost through the centuries. So the Targum of Genesis 3:8 is particularly interesting. It says, Ushma'u yat kol memra da Adonai Elohim mehalech veginta. Okay, so there's some Aramaic practice for you if you're a bit rusty on it. And basically it says, and they heard the voice of the word of Adonai, God, walking in the garden. So the addition in the text is the word. And so, again, this is interesting for New Testament scholars because, you know, in the beginning was the word was with God. John 1, you have the Targums adding in the word memra, word, into this passage, suggesting that the word is the one walking in the garden. Again, very, very interesting. You know, there's a lot that could be and has been said about this kind of thing. But the point for us is that the translator of this passage is saying, this is what's actually going on. This is the person that's actually being referred to. I'm going to make sure the reader understands that it's the word of Adonai, God, who was walking in the garden, not just him, okay? So that is density change, providing a further explanation of the text, right? Or sometimes you can make things implicit as well, but that's usually not the case. The next kind of expression change is resegmentation. So classic example of this, Ephesians 1, 3-10, one long sentence in Greek, pretty much any translation is going to have more than one sentence. So basically resegmentation is just changing the number of sentences or resegmenting the text syntactically to make more sense in the target language, right? So even though it's one sentence in Greek, even a literal translation like the LSB has two, the NIV has five, right? Point is, everyone's going to do this to some extent. The question is, how much are you going to do it? When are you going to do it? And why are you going to do it? Okay. And then finally, cultural correspondence. So I mentioned that, you know, copying structure is just, you know, could be taking one idiom and literally just copying word for word what that idiom says into the other language, even if it doesn't make very much sense. Like, and we will speak mouth to mouth. You could also do cultural correspondence. We don't have that idiom. So the LSB, again, a very literal translation, translates it as face-to-face. That doesn't, you know, again, literally mean face-to-face, meaning the word stoma doesn't literally mean face. It means mouth. That being said, the idiom, mouth-to-mouth, is equivalent to our idiom in English, face-to-face. So the LSB translators and most other translations just say, okay, these idioms are very close. Let's just go with our idiom so that the reader can understand. Again, the question is, when do you do this and why? Finally, we can have material changes in the text. We can delete things, add things, summarize things. Usually in Bible translation, this isn't really done a ton. But, you know, if you think about a little outside the box, kids' Bibles, right, are adaptations of a text for a different audience where the material is rearranged, rewritten, so that the new audience can understand better. That's a great example of text tailoring. The Diatessaron is another one. This is the oldest harmony of the Gospels. It is done in Syriac. And so basically it was a compilation of all four Gospels rewritten to give a comprehensive life of Jesus. Again, does that count as a translation? I don't know. This is on the fringes of what a translation means or what we mean by translation today. But this is the point, is that people are doing all kinds of things like this with the Bible. And that brings up this larger point, which is holding to the authority of Scripture doesn't necessitate a certain translation philosophy. So I want to be clear on that, because many people will kind of suggest that, especially the tendency is to suggest that people who are literal are being more faithful to the original, and people who advocate for a more free translation are being less faithful to the original. As I've said, everyone is engaging in all seven of the methods that we talked about. They are just doing it in different ways at different times. Some people, the quote-unquote word-for-word translations, which none of them purely hold to that philosophy, those translations just are going to translate in a certain way most of the time, whereas other translations are just going to do it differently. That doesn't mean that one group has a higher authority of Scripture than the other. Really, the question is, what strategies should be employed to best communicate the message in a particular passage to the intended audience? So that could mean all kinds of different strategies, right? We went over seven. We went over copying words like Bethlehem, copying structure. We will speak mouth to mouth. That's one way you can do it. Perspective change, right? Just changing the subject. Density change, adding information so that the reader understands. Resegmentation, changing the syntax. Cultural correspondence, right? Translating mouth to mouth as face to face. And text tailoring, just really summarizing, let's say, the text for a different audience. So all of these things are legitimate strategies that are employed by everyone. The question is, when and why, right? So again, calling a translation free or literal doesn't mean you're being more or less faithful to the original. The hard work of translation really comes into play in interpreting the original message. So you have to interpret the original message first. It's not being more faithful to the original to be word for word, because you could be misrepresenting the text if you just translate word for word, because the words are not always going to match up. So as a reader, the question is, what strategy does the particular version you are reading use most often? This is not a value judgment. You just need to be aware of what the translation committee is doing with that particular translation. So I just want to go over some of the translation problems, some that were brought up during the series and some that are just fun. So one of them was Adelphos. So this is one that Dr. Lynn Kowick and I talked about, and it was a lot of fun for me. It was off the cuff, as I said in that episode. I hadn't planned to talk about this, but it's one that's very popular and one that's controversial. So the question is, do you translate Adelphos as brother or brother and sister when it is assumed that there are multiple genders being referred to. So there's a lot in play here. But the two big questions, right, are one, what does the word adelphos mean in Greek? And two, what does the word brother mean in English? So let's just suppose that adelphos isn't marked for gender in Greek. So you immediately say to me, it has an os at the end. It's ho adelphos. It is marked for gender. Well, yes, but things aren't that simple. Many times, the feminine counterpart is the one that's marked and the so-called masculine is more neutral. Not neuter, but neutral. Meaning that it can refer to both genders. Again, like this is how many, many languages are. If you have a group of people, you know, in Hebrew, for example, if you have a group of people and you are addressing them, you, you would use the masculine form if there is one male and all female. That's just typically how it works. I mean, that's changing today, but that's typically how it works. Okay, so that means that the masculine form is actually neutral and the feminine form is the marked form, meaning the feminine form tells you this is all women, whereas the masculine form tells you this is at least some men. Okay, that means that the masculine form doesn't actually mean all men. So if the word brother, again, backing up, if adelphos means that, I haven't checked it myself, so you can go do your homework on it. But if the word adelphos can clearly refer to both brothers and sisters, then the question is, in English, does the word brother behave like that? Can I call a woman brother in certain contexts? And would they understand that to be referring to them? Again, that's a bit of an empirical question. As a sort of funny aside, I think the word bro actually does work in these kinds of contexts. So I do know this set of twin girls who call each other bro. Shout out to the Hinchman twins. So they call each other bro, which is very, very interesting, right? Because for this discussion, because here they are taking, you know, a shortened form of brother, and neither one of them are male, and they're using this term not to refer to gender. They're using it in a very different way, however the word bro is used in English. And it could be that the word adelphos takes on some of this meaning in the New Testament. Again, I'm not even making this argument, but this kind of meaning of, hey, family member, right? That could be the meaning in a lot of cases, right? Which means maybe we just translate it as sibling. Maybe adelphos has come to mean something like, hey, we're family now, and not you are the son of my parents. I don't know. Again, the point here is that these are all considerations that you need to be aware of when translating the text, all right, and when reading translations yourself. It's, again, not the case that the people who are translating brother and sister are doing something, they're not necessarily changing the text. If the word adelphos literally or originally was referring to people of both genders and it was referring to just a family member, then that would be an accurate translation. If brother in English didn't have that range of meaning. Again, those are just the questions that you need to be asking yourself. Okay, another fun example is the Shema. I know this is not New Testament, but one that I've been working on and one that illustrates some of the fun issues. So the last clause of the Shema, Adonai Echad, is normally translated Adonai is one. I've argued, again, I have a video on this that you can check out or a podcast episode. I've argued that the better translation is Adonai is the one. And there's a lot of reasons for this that I actually don't go into in that short little clip. But basically, Echad, right, doesn't have the definite article. But the question is not whether the form matches, but whether the meaning matches. So the question is, how is Echad used, the word one, in Hebrew? And how is Ha-Echad used in Hebrew, the one? And how does that match up with one in English and the one in English? And my contention is Adonai is the one is a better match for Adonai Echad. Again, I have a lot of reasons for this that I can't go into. My only point is, are you being less faithful to the text by inserting the word the if the original authors intended it to be read as Adonai is the only one. I mean, I don't think you're misrepresenting the text by saying that. I think you're misrepresenting the text by saying Adonai is one, right? Because the text has a certain meaning. It's our job to figure out that meaning and then put that meaning into the target language in the way that makes sense in the target language. So if again, in theory, Echad is equivalent to the one in this context, then that is the most faithful translation, right? Even though you are, quote unquote, adding the word the. Everyone is adding words all the time. The question is, when do you need to do that? And that is dependent upon exegesis or interpretation, right? Figuring out what the original text means. So again, that brings us to, you know, a fun one that I mentioned with Dr. Mu, Dikaiosune de Theou Diapisteos Iesu Christou. Another one that I've worked on, the Pistis Christou debate. Different translations do this in different ways. Most translations say faith in Christ. So what they have to argue for grammatically is Pisteos Iesu Christou. The genitive is equivalent to the English word in. I argue that that's not possible with this particular word. Christ's faithfulness, they have to argue grammatically that pisteos means faithfulness and that the genitive is equivalent to, you know, the little apostrophe S. Okay, that has to be their argument. I say the Christ faith, where I argue that pisteos is referring to a specific entity, so we should use the definite article in English, and that the genitive is equivalent to our English compound word construction. Again, those are all grammatical arguments. The point here is the translation is based on whatever grammatical argument is best, right? Given the context, given how these words are used in Greek. So those are the kinds of things that have to be considered when doing a translation. Finally, Matthew 8:8, Hina mu hypoten stegen is eltes, so that you might come under my roof. So I'm actually taking this out of context. The previous clause says, I'm not worthy that you would come under my roof. This is the centurion talking to Jesus. What is super interesting about this syntactically is hina mu hupo ten stegen. So the mu we would normally expect to go with the noun, that it means my, and no translation that I have seen puts the my in any other place other than right before the word roof. So I'm not worthy that you would come under my roof, because in English you have to put it right before the noun. However, in Greek, this word order is quite unexpected. To have the mu come before the preposition that introduces the noun, that puts it in a very, very weird place. I think that the reason why it is put there is for the sake of focus. The way we do focus in English is intonation. So we would say something like, and I am not worthy that you would come under my roof, right? Meaning, you might come under other people's roofs, right? But my roof, I am not worthy. And that fits the context perfectly, adds something to the meaning that you don't get in most translations or any translations that I've seen. And the only modification you need is just bolding my, right? You bold my, and all of a sudden that meaning comes into play and it reflects, I would argue, the Greek. The Greek moves the word my to an unordinary place in the sentence for the sake of this focus interpretation. You can't do that in English, right? Because we don't move like that for this kind of meaning. What we do is we stress that word, right? And so we can represent that in the text by just bolding the letters. Here's my point here. This is the kind of thing that I think should be in translations more, right? We have a certain meaning in the text, in the original, right? We're trying to communicate that in the target language. In the original, what they do to communicate that meaning is move the word. In the target language, they can't move the word. All they do is change the intonation, and we can represent that by bolding the word. That's the kind of thing, again, that everyone is doing to some extent. Everyone's moving words around. The question is why, right? And when. And this is one where I think translations should be more open to this kind of thing, to bolding a word in the text, where you would have this sort of focus interpretation in the original because it better reflects the understanding of the original audience. So last, let me just talk a little bit about how to read translations, just very briefly, some guiding principles. First, all translations are interpretations, and I've tried to stress that throughout this wrap-up. You can't get away from trying to figure out what the text means. I talked to Dr. William Varner about this. He was on the translation committee for the LSB, and John MacArthur said, this is not an interpretation, it's a translation or something like that. That's not true. Everyone is interpreting. If they're not, then what you are reading is the original. And so necessarily, even if you're doing word for word, you have to decide that this particular Greek word matches this particular English word best. And that means interpreting the original Greek word. You can't get around this. There are some translations that do this better and some that don't do it as well. The point here is that you should just accept, right, that all of the translations are going to be an interpretation. You are reading it through the translator's lens. Now, that lens is going to be a certain color, right? It's going to color the text in a certain way. And what you need to do is be aware of how that's coloring the text. You need to be aware that if you choose a word-for-word translation, what they're going to do, by and large, is take one Greek word and try to match it to one English word, okay? But that doesn't mean that that's more faithful to the original. It just means that that's their method of trying to communicate the meaning of the original. So that brings me to something I tell often to people. If you are studying a passage, you need to read translations with different translation philosophies. It is not helpful to read the King James Version and the New King James Version right next to each other, right? I mean, it could be for other reasons. But in terms of trying to get at what the original text means through a translation, what you're doing is you're taking two translations with such similar philosophies and putting them right next to each other. They're almost certainly going to have the same thing, or the differences are going to be very, very slight. Versus what I normally tell people is take a literal word-for-word translation, ESV, take freer translation, NLT, and take one in the middle, NIV, read them together, see what the differences are, and from there, you can think about, okay, how are they understanding the context, right? How are they understanding this passage, and how are they reflecting that in their translation? Then you can ask yourself, okay, how am I understanding this context? And if these are the translation options, then you can hopefully come to a better understanding of the text and pick a translation that you think is best in that particular passage. There is no most accurate translation, right? It's all dependent upon how they take particular passages and how they interpret those passages, because every single one of them are doing interpretation. Another kind of note, and one thing I recommend to people, is to look at the NET Bible, because it has translators' notes. So that's pretty helpful to see. They often give multiple options when there's debate about different options, and they'll say why they chose one option over the other. So that, again, it's just another resource for people that are reading a translation. But of course, I don't think that you should be reading a translation at all. I think that the best translation is no translation, and it is very possible to read the New Testament or the Hebrew Bible in the original languages. So I would be remiss if I did not say that I think that's possible. I think it's more possible than most people realize. You can do it with just a little bit of time each day with Biblingo. There are actually a lot of other resources out there to help you. So I would encourage you, again, not to abandon all translations, but to pick up Greek or Hebrew, Aramaic too. But you can just start with Greek because we're talking about New Testament translation right now. But the point is that, as we've said, if you want to get into the weeds of the text, you really do need to know the original, because all translations already have interpreted the text for you. So if you want to say, hey, I really want to know what this passage means, there really is no better place to go than the original, because it's there that you can start to engage and see the text in different ways that the translators might have screened out, because they might have said, hey, this interpretation is not correct, might be misunderstood, so let's change the word order, right, and put it into English in this way. But they might have misread the text to begin with without knowing Greek, you can't decide that question for yourself. So again, I would encourage you to go out, get started on learning Greek so that you can start to read the Bible in the original language and you don't have to rely on these other translations or interpretations. That's all we have time for in this episode of the Biblical Languages Podcast. Thank you to everyone for joining us.
Thank you for listening to the Biblical Languages Podcast, brought to you by Biblingo. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast app and leave us a review. You can also follow Biblingo on social media to discuss the episode with us and other listeners. And don't forget to visit biblingo.org to start your 10-day free trial of Biblingo.